Revelation chapter 18, economic Babylon burning. Now, I have done my best to try to prepare you for this message, to try to prepare you for this study. I've mentioned, I believe, no short of three or four times now, that there is a difference between the Babylon that we see in Revelation chapter 17 and the Babylon that we see in Revelation chapter 18. The good news, the great thing, is that they both fall at the pouring out of the seventh and final bowl judgment. But let me just briefly give you a few of the differences that you'll find as you compare chapter 17 Babylon with chapter 18 Babylon. Now, there's more than this, but here are the big ones, the highlights. The Babylon of chapter 17 is for a while useful to the kings of the earth, but eventually, after that usefulness wears off, the Babylon of chapter 17 is then hated by the kings of the earth, but the Babylon of chapter 18 is loved and cherished by the kings of the earth. They don't want to let her go. The Babylon of chapter 17 is, after its usefulness has proved itself and expended itself, it is destroyed by the kings of the earth themselves. That is Antichrist and his government. They turn on her. They hate her, so they destroy her. But the Babylon of chapter 18, that's something that the Lord has to destroy, because the kings of the world, the government of the world, the Antichrist, they don't want to let her go. And so you'll see a lot in this chapter, them just bellyaching and blubbering and sobbing uncontrollably because they lost this system. And then finally, the Babylon that we see in chapter 17 is spoken about in terms that could only be interpreted as a rebellious religious system. And the Babylon that we read about in chapter 18 is spoken about in terms that could only be interpreted and understood as a rebellious economic system. And that really is all the more that you need to know about the identity of the Babylon of chapter 17 and the Babylon of chapter 18. I know that having curious minds like we do, just being typical human beings, we always want to further pin things down, and we're always so anxious to try to put proper names to things. For example, some will say that the Babylon of chapter 18 that we're going to begin studying here today, Lord willing, some will say it is the literal city of Babylon. In modern times, that would be the modern city of Iraq. So many people will teach that chapter 18 is telling us that Iraq is going to somehow become the hub of the global economy during the time of the tribulation. I think that's a little absurd, quite honestly. But, you know, they do have some texts, biblical Old Testament prophecies that they'll point to. But I don't think those Old Testament prophets are saying what they think they're saying. I think there are much better explanations for that. Next, one of the more popular interpretations in trying to give a proper name to Babylon chapter 18 is America. Now, before you think I'm going to totally dismiss that, I will say that I kind of come into the same weird positioning that I was in Revelation chapter 17, because, you know, I told you I didn't want to go so far as to make the statement that the Roman Catholic Church is exclusively going to be the religious Babylon, the harlot that we see in Revelation chapter 17. I told you I don't want to go that far, but using my eyeballs and my brain, I can look at the Roman Catholic Church and I can say, wow, does that fit the description? So, certainly the Roman Catholic Church is not the great harlot, but it could be the platform from which that great harlot, that global one world religion, forms and then prospers until eventually Antichrist destroys it. And I would make a similar statement here, because I can't help but to read the description that Revelation 18 gives me and think to myself, am I reading about America? Now, I'll tell you straight out, I don't believe that America is the Babylon of Revelation 18. I don't believe America is this economic global power. However, I can think of few countries that would fit the descriptions that we're going to read about better than the U.S. So I will say this, just as perhaps the Roman Catholic Church is the platform from which all of the world's religions become unified, I will say that it is perhaps possible that America becomes the hub for this global economy that Antichrist is going to wield during the tribulation period. Now, whether that is true or not, it really is beside the point, because sometimes when you're trying to get the specifics like that, you're not being more helpful to yourself. You're actually being unhelpful. You're being distracting, and you're getting away from the major point that the passage would try to teach us. And I think, if anything, the reason why this Revelation 18 economy, global system, looks so much like America, if nothing else, it's because this global economy is going to utilize the same system that America utilizes, at least for now, and that is capitalism. Go figure. That's going to be Antichrist's global economy. Can you believe that? He does not use communism or socialism like you might expect from a dictator, right? Now, he's going to do that through policies, but as far as the economy is concerned, it is not going to be communism or socialism. It is going to be capitalism. So credit where credit is due. As wicked as his heart is, he's no dummy. He understands that capitalism is the answer to a thriving economy. Now, if we have time, we will delve into that, perhaps, those issues, those topics a little further in our Revelation 18 study. But for now, here's what I want to do. I want to make this as easy as I can for you to understand this. I want you to just strip away the Old Testament term Babylon, and I want to bring you back to the way that I already defined this for you. Remember, I said that the Lord uses this term in a very specific way to give out a very specific spiritual message all throughout the Bible. Now, it started at the Tower of Babel. That's the roots of this thing. And that word Babel means confusion. But the city of Babylon then sprung up from those roots. And from that point forward, the Lord, when he uses that term, he uses it to speak of a rebellious, anti-God system or government. And he applies it in many different areas throughout the scripture. So if you take the word Babylon and just get rid of it, if it's confusing you, and hold on to that word rebellion or rebellious, then here's what you're going to end up with. Here's what that's going to leave you with. Chapter 17, then, in its irreducible minimum, is what God thinks about rebellious religious systems apart from him and what he's going to do about it. We already studied that. Chapter 18, then, in that same vein, is what God thinks of rebellious anti-God economies and what he's going to do about it when the world catches up to Revelation chapter 18. So give me your attention for a few minutes today as we look around in this chapter and sift through the remaining rubble. We've got one more chapter to cover, one more chapter to look at the decimation caused by that final and seventh bowl judgment that the Lord had poured out in Revelation chapter 16. Verse 1, let's begin reading. After these things, I saw another angel, a heavenly angel, coming down from heaven, having great authority, because he's on assignment from the Lord, who is going to speak to us from heaven in verse 4. And the earth was illuminated with his glory because this angel has just descended from heaven, having spent time deeply in the presence of God. And that is the byproduct of being near God. The glow of God's glory is on you. We learned that lesson from Moses, who spent time up on the mountaintop there on Mount Sinai, deep in the presence of the Lord, communing with the Lord. And when he came down, his face was glowing. It's the same thing for us. I'm convinced that that would actually happen if we spent as much time deeply in the presence of the Lord as we, well, I won't say could. Our schedules are busy. But barring our schedules, as we could, that shows on our countenance. God's glory can be seen on us. It's a visible and detectable thing, even to the ungodly and the worldly. Reading on, verse 2, and he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen. I made the life alert joke last time. I won't do that this time. But I just want to stress to you, this angel, he does not have a stuttering problem. He did not lose his place and have to come back to it. He is intentionally repeating himself in order to make an emphasis. Now, in English, when we want to emphasize something, if it's in the spoken word, we do that by the inflection of our voice, like I just did. If it's in the written word, what do to stress or emphasize something? Well, some people put everything in all caps. Don't do that, please. The rest of us think you're shouting at us. But no, we're talking proper English style here. What do when you want to stress something in written word? You add an exclamation point to it. But for both the Hebrew and the Greek speakers, in both the spoken word and the written word, they did not do that. They gave emphasis based on repetition. And so if they wanted to emphasize something, they would repeat it as many times as necessary to give them what they felt to be the proper emphasis. And that's what this angel is doing. But here's the really cool thing I think I see in this. Well, I know I see it. I'm not sure if it's right or not. Whether intended or not, the double stress of the fall of Babylon actually sits perfect, because that's precisely what we're studying. We're studying the double fall of Babylon. The last 2 weeks, chapter 17, the fall of religious Babylon. This week, the fall of economic Babylon. So indeed, as the angel says, Babylon is fallen. And do you remember, this was already anticipated and announced to us back in the second message delivered by the second angel there in Revelation chapter 14, verse 8. He gave this exact statement. He said, Babylon is fallen. And he said that before any of the seven bowl judgments were poured out on the earth. That was like, this has happened, past tense. It didn't really happen yet, but it was such a sure thing, such a done deal, so guaranteed by God that it was spoken of in the past tense terms. Well, that was the anticipation of this, the promise, the guarantee. This is what the Lord wants to do, so by golly, he's going to do it. And now, chapter 18, verse 2, we see the accomplishment of it. It's done. Babylon is down for good. Reading on. Babylon is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, that is a second reference to demons, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird, that is a third reference to demons. Again, we're getting emphasis, but you'll see that anytime that the scriptures use the word birds in a metaphoric way, it is always spoken to represent demonic spirits. Here's a good proof text for that. Go back to the parable of the sower. As given to us by Jesus, Jesus said that the seed of the word is planted and the birds of the air come and eat, devour, pick away at those seeds that were planted in the soil. And he explained to us what they were. They were demons. They were unclean spirits. So, verse 2, there's demons in the machine. There's demons behind this global economic system of the Antichrist. It is a side of commercialism and consumerism that most of us would not even be aware of had the Bible not given us these warnings throughout, that demonic spirits are very actively involved in the economic systems of the world, especially this final global economic system of Antichrist. The consumer, what do we see? Oh, well, we see the nicely polished and well-dressed presentation. We see the appealing products, and then we want them. The funny thing is, we were absolutely fine without them. We didn't know that we wanted them until the advertisers proved to us why we should want them, and now we want them. What is happening in that case? Consumerism and commercialism. What's happening there? Here's what's happening. Merchants are using their products to incite us to lust and covetousness. Here's what they're doing. They are lusting after your money. They're lusting after our funds. So to get that, they produce something that we will lust after so that we can have what we're lusting after and they can have what they're lusting after, our money. Isn't that crazy? That's what's happening. Now, apart from true necessities like food and clothing, that's given to us in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 8, Paul says, "And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content." What about a house? That's real easy to build a shelter. I know that's a lost art, but it's real easy to build a shelter. No, your true necessities are food and clothing. Paul says, if you got that, you should be content. Apart from those, the rest of the system is built around appeals to our lust from merchants who are lusting. So maybe you struggle seeing it, but according to verse 2, I'm going to go ahead and assume that God has no trouble seeing it. God sees the corrupt underbelly of consumerism and commercialism. God sees the exploitation that is taking place just to squeeze out a few more pennies or dollars from you. He sees the slave labor that's taking place. He sees the price gouging and the market manipulation. He sees the false advertising. He sees the deception behind it, the greed, the covetousness, and the lust, and much more. God knows what inspires all of that. And his verdict in verse 2 is that it is demonically influenced and controlled. These are foul spirits wrapped up in every phase of commercialism. Why do you think the Bible warns us so much about not getting sucked into that? We'll talk about that a little bit more here. But for now, let's read verse 3. For all the nations, none excluded, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth, rulers and leaders, have committed fornication. And again, just like last week, we are not going to think of that word in sexual terms. We know that the Lord is using it in a metaphoric way. So don't be thinking sexual unfaithfulness. Be thinking spiritual unfaithfulness. The kings of the earth have committed spiritual unfaithfulness with her, with this commercial system of Antichrist. And the merchants have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. That last statement should really grab your attention. That is the announcement of the condition of Antichrist's one world economy at the very end of the tribulation. Would you expect that? I don't know if you remember back this far, but in our early studies, Revelation chapter 6, as the Lord peeled back that third seal judgment, something happened to the economy. Very early on in the tribulation period, there's going to be a devastating blow that is struck upon this world's economy. Now, the Bible does not, like, chapter by chapter give us the update on Antichrist economic stock market numbers. So we don't really follow that through the scriptures. But what they do in Revelation is they first announce the global conditions economically beginning early on in the tribulation. And now in Revelation chapter 18, after all is said and done, we get an update. So what I want to do is I want to take you back. I want to rewind you to and reread to you the third seal judgment in Revelation chapter 6, verses 5 and 6. Here's what it says. The Lord having peeled back that third seal judgment. John says, I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. Verse 6. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. So that was the early on condition of Earth's economy when God began pouring out his judgment in the tribulation. To put what we just read in relatable terms, you would have to pay, because a denarius is a day's wage at this time, you would have to pay somewhere between $100 to $200 to get enough wheat to almost make a loaf of bread. Almost. Now, if you wanted to go the more cost-effective route at this time, the beginning of the tribulation, you could buy, for the same price, a day's wage, you could buy almost enough barley to make two loaves of bread. So what you're doing is you're giving every bit of money that you make every day just to try to keep your family from starving. That's how things began in the tribulation. But we just read the update in verse 3 about what Antichrist does with the economy throughout the remainder of the tribulation. He recovers it, doesn't he? The economy that Antichrist sets up after that first catastrophic strike to the economy ends up flourishing, becoming very prosperous and very successful. And it's quite a different story when you get to Revelation 18 and see the success of it and compare that to the incredible out-of-control inflation that we saw at the beginning in Revelation chapter 6. Inflation being a thing that we are unfortunately and unwantedly getting more and more acquainted with in the current administration. So what he's done is he's taken that economy from people barely being able to have enough bread to now, late at the very end of the tribulation, they're rolling in the dough. Stark contrast. His government, it's working. His economy, it's working. How well does it work? Verse 3 said, it's going to create an abundance of luxury. Let me pick out a few more words from this chapter. You'll see them sprinkled throughout. Here's a few more words that tell you about the success of Antichrist economic system. Words like this: rich, wealth, and luxury. You'll read those quite regularly in the chapter. So the conclusion being that from an economic standpoint, Antichrist is brilliant. His plan will work. He will recover the global economy from that early inflation. The incredible thing is, when you stop and think about it, everything that he was able to protect that economy from during the time of tribulation. When you consider the backdrop of the tribulation period, it is incredible that his economy will prosper like this. Here's God pouring out judgment after judgment on the world. There's catastrophes, there's earthquakes, there's plagues and pestilences. There's all sorts of cataclysms striking at various aspects of life on earth. And yet the whole time it's Antichrist economy, bull markets throughout. The Dow is up the whole time until the Lord says that it's time for all of it to come crashing down. Revelation chapter 18, it's exactly what we are studying. Verse 4, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues." Verse 5, "For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." Now, I have important things to say here, but I just want to get this thought out of my head because it just popped in, and I think it's important. Babylon, the original nation, not the Tower of Babel that was destroyed by God, but Babylon, the original nation. No, actually, let me go back to the Tower of Babel. What was the whole point of the Tower of Babel? What did they want to accomplish? They said with that tower that they were building, with that ziggurat, what they wanted to do was reach the heavens. And they didn't. But something did reach the heavens from this Babylonian system. Their sins. Their sins came up before God in heaven. Now, what we see in verses 4 and 5 is a long-awaited call for those who have spent somewhere between 3.5 to 7 years resisting Antichrist's demands. They don't surrender. They don't succumb to the system. They don't take the mark. They don't listen to the dictates of Antichrist. They are totally anti-Antichrist. That's pretty good. I just thought of that. They are totally anti-Antichrist during the tribulation, and they stand for Christ instead. And that's going to cause them great suffering. Likely, there will be some Gentiles that make it thus far, but mainly, I think the point is driving at a group of people that we studied about and just sort of left in the caves in our study. The nation of Israel. For 3.5 years now, as we come to Revelation 18, for 3.5 years, they've been tucked away in Petra. Because the Lord is protecting them there, shielding them from the movements and dictates of Antichrist. For 3.5 years, there they are, stuck in the caves, stuck in the rocks, trying to eke out a survival because God called them to Petra. And they've been waiting for this call for a long time, this call where God says, come out of her, my people. Come out of the system because the system is getting destroyed. But if you want, make a note that this is God's call to every generation. There's not a single generation that God does not issue the same exact call to, for us to come out from among them and be a separate people. It started with the very first Jew, if you will, when God called Abram. What was the first thing he asked him to do? He called Abram to leave, to depart, to come out of Ur of the Chaldees. Abraham's nephew Lot, the Lord issued this same call. He got, unfortunately, invested in the system there in Sodom. And God gave this call to Lot to come out of Sodom because Sodom was going to be destroyed. You know the story. Lot did not want to leave. He was too intertwined and all tangled up in the culture, and he didn't want to leave it. He was a leader within that city, and he had to be dragged out of there kicking and screaming by an angel to save his life. Then on and on you go through the stories. You'll see this many times in every generation. To every generation, God calling his people out from the system of the world that would drag them away from God and calling them to be separate people for himself. The Lord calls us today, Christians, New Testament Christians, with that same calling. Let me give this to you in John's words. You know this passage well. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. You could probably quote it along with me. If you did, that would make this pastor very happy. The Apostle John tells us, "Do not love the world." Now, first thing I want to say is that John is not talking about the world of people, because the Father himself so loved the world of people that he gave his only begotten Son. So we're not talking about people. When the Bible uses that word, world, in this way, it is speaking of the system. It's the world or lifestyle that is apart from God or anti-God. So John says, do not love the world, the system, or the things in the world, the products, the merchandise. You're going to have them if you're going to keep up with modern society. But do not love them. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. A very bold statement indeed. For all that is in the world, the worldly system, listen to this. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. Verse 17. And the world, I love this part, and the world is passing away, and the lust of it, that's exactly what we're studying in Revelation chapter 18. It is the doomsday of the worldly system and everything that comes with it. The greed, the covetousness, the lust, the corruption, it's all coming down. It's not going to last. It's not going to withstand, but there is something that will. John says, he who does the will of God abides forever. Now, what we're talking about here, this call out of the ungodly systems of the world and into the nearness and closeness of God's theocratic government as a separate people, what we're studying here is both correctly and incorrectly demonstrated to us in the same pop by the nation of Israel, fittingly enough, in their Babylonian captivity way back in 606 BC. You're familiar with the Babylonian captivity, right? Babylon came down and conquered the nation of Israel. The weak and the elderly, they left there in the region of Israel, Jerusalem and all that. The rest of them, they drug up north into Babylon. And after 70 years of bondage to Babylon, 70 years of being subjected and subjugated under this Babylonian government, God released them. I would say, furthermore, God went beyond just releasing them. He called them back to the land. He called them back to Israel, specifically Jerusalem, to begin to rebuild the temple, the walls of Jerusalem, the surrounding cities. And would you believe, they came in streams. And eventually, only 50,000 Jews returned to their homeland. What happened? They were under the bondage of that Babylonian government, but the Lord freed them. The Lord opened up the heart of the king and freed them. But what happened? That kingdom of Babylon, they were still bound to it in their hearts. I'll tell you what happened. They liked it there. Babylon was a completely different system than what the nation of Israel was used to. Israel had always been an agrarian society, an agricultural society. From the beginning, the nation worked the land. They raised livestock, animals. They planted and harvested. They were an agrarian society. But things were way different in Babylon. Here's what Babylon was: commercialism and consumerism. Babylon was a movement toward an industrial society, dare I even say, in some forms, a technological society. And they got up there in Babylon, and they enjoyed the ease and the entertainment of the system, and they didn't want to leave the system. They didn't want to go back to being farmers, agricultural workers. That's hard work. Sweat of the brow stuff. No, man, in Babylon, I can be soothed, comforted, and entertained. Well, unfortunately, folks, this is not very popular, but this country has followed that same kind of pattern. This country began as an agrarian society. We worked the land. We sowed. And we harvested. We raised livestock. We worked hard. But along came the Industrial Revolution. And man, under the agrarian society of this country early on, we were good. We were healthy. Things were great. We were close to our families because we were working with our families. We needed one another. The children knew that they were needed. They were participating in providing for the family through the work. The family was always together. And good things were coming from that. There was a trust in God, just like Israel in their agrarian society. It was an agrarian society that trusted in God, but when the Industrial Revolution began in this country, we turned our trust and affection away from God and our agrarian lifestyle, and we got our trust and our affection on factories and machines and industry. It was a move away from dependence on God, and it was a move toward our independence. Were we better off for it? Hold that thought, because that wasn't the end of it. The next step in our quote-unquote progression and movement as a society was that we then left the Industrial Revolution. What are we in now? The Technological Revolution. Is that better? Is that worse? And that is far worse. Now our trusts and our affections have moved so far away from God. Our trusts and our affections are on the things that we see on the computer and can do with the computer. How has that affected families? 62% of families, both parents, work long hours in order to make enough money to survive in this kind of economy. 62%. Now, it would be much higher, but of course, there's been a lot of job loss over the handful of years. It used to be 81%. Both parents worked in order to provide in that system, in this system, the technological revolution. How are families? How are they doing? Well, the kids that used to be with mom and dad side by side, taught by mom and dad, feeling useful and needed because they're right there helping mom and dad, being raised by mom and dad, that's not happening in this revolution, in this progress of system. Now, usually both parents are out working all day. Kids are being raised by someone else. And when they are home altogether, they're isolated because they got to have a screen in front of their face. They got to have a computer or a TV to watch. Maybe not all of you agree with this, but this system that we are living in right now, it is terrible for us. Let me just highlight one major difference. When Israel was in an agrarian society, when America was in an agrarian society, when any nation was enveloped and involved in an agrarian society, there was no such thing as needing psychiatrists and psychotics. Just not a thing. Look at us now. We need psychiatrists to tell our kids, oh, you are loved, honey. Your parents do want you. They don't have time for you, but that's okay. They do want you. You're okay. Feel good about yourself. And we gotta push the psychotics on them to get their minds to just level out and not be depressed and suicidal. Do you think God, let me ask you this. I mean, Revelation 18 answers it, but do you think that the Lord likes this society that we live in? Do you think he likes this system? Do you think he likes the technological age, this revolution? Do you think he does? Can I, again, take you back to Genesis 11? This was the ploy for Babel. The ploy was, let's break out of this system. Let's do our own thing. Let's become advanced. Let's build something big that has a powerful name to it. And God toppled it. God stopped their intentions. But mankind, we wouldn't let it go in our hearts. We persisted in it over the millennia, and eventually it developed and we became industrial, and now we're technological. God finally just took his hands off things and let us go and build this progressive and empowered system. But how do you think he feels about it? What did he call us to? Genesis chapter 3. Mankind was to what? Cultivate the land. Mankind was to be agrarian. The Lord never intended the system to get bloated and filled with corruption like this. And now we have a mess on our hands. And what do we do? I'll tell you what, if it was me, the first thing I would do is cut the plug to the internet. I'd find wherever the plug is. And I would pull it, and I would shred it, and I would cut it. No more internet. I would turn it off for good. It is destroying us. It is corrupting us. There is no way to prevent that. Now, true Christians are always going to be true Christians. Know what? But the rest of the system, it's corrupting us. It is destroying us from within, from the heart, from the family, to the community, to the nation. It's destroying us. I would cut the plug. And there's no way. There's absolutely no way to change the commercial economic system with its consumerism so that there's no propensity or tendency toward corruption and lust and covetousness. There's no way to stop that. If I were running the world, you ought to praise God today that I'm not. I would take us back to an agrarian society when we didn't need psychiatrists and psychotics. When we were just happy and healthy because we were living close to the land as God designed it for us. Why do you think that the Amish are doing so well? Listen, you didn't think I just went out to Amish country for a vacation, did you? No, that was for work. I was doing research out there. I still have all my vacation time remaining. The board's going to be watching me real close now with that. Why do you think they're doing so well? Now, I know that you've probably seen some stupid TV show like the Amish Mafia or, you know, one of those stories about when the Amish leave. Now, when they leave for theological reasons, and I'll grant them that. Theologically, the Amish are, they're off. They're not quite right. But I tell you what, they do have two things going for them. Their society, their agrarian lifestyle, and their devotion to God, even though it is theologically flawed. And I know there are shows about how awful it is to be Amish and how people just can't wait to get out of there. But here's the facts. We learned this on our trip when we were on our research trip. Here's the facts. During Rumspringa, you know what Rumspringa is? It means running around. That's a period of time that when a child gets to the teenage years, is it 16? I think it's 16. When they become 16 years of age, the Amish people, their families, something I would never do, they release their kids to go rumspringa, run around in the world with the English. That's what they call us all. You can be black, white, Asian, whatever, but if you live in this country and you're not Amish, they call you English. And for that period of time, they will turn their children out to the world. They say, go ahead, go sow your wild oats. Literally, that's what they're telling them. Go do your thing, experiment with the world, run around a little bit, but when you come back, when that period of rumspringa is up, you have to make a decision. And when you make that decision, if you decide to stay, you're getting baptized. And if you ever leave after your baptism, you're getting shunned, permanently shunned. And 10% of people that go out on rumspringa, those teenagers, 10% of people decide, I don't want to go back. Babylon, man, this is nice. It's comfy. It's cozy. It's ease. It's entertainment. I love this. No work. I don't have to work. My fingers can rest. My calluses can heal. This is the life these English haven't figured out in their technological advancements. Man, I'm sticking. 10% do that. And after a period of time, before that period is up, the stats show that 7% of them who decided to leave the Amish for the English, us, 7% go back. So the total number is 3%. 3% of Amish youth end up leaving the Amish church and the Amish society. But let me tell you just some of the facts about that society. God is their life. Apart from work, God is their life. Everything centers around God. They got that part right. They work and live close to the land, so they eat close to the land. Their diet is usually better, so they don't have the health issues that we do. They live longer than we do. They live healthier than we do. They get to old age, and those old men and those old women, they're still out there working in the fields, plowing and harvesting because they're healthy in their old age. They don't need psychiatrists. Their families aren't breaking and splitting apart. Couples aren't divorcing. Life is solid. There's benefits to that lifestyle. And here we are thinking we are superior as we swipe through the pages of the internet and find something new to lust after today. Some new thing to buy or some new lifestyle to desire in our hearts. Something that makes us feel inferior and unfulfilled. And now we need our psychiatrists and our psychotics again. God, help us. Well, we didn't make it to the end of the chapter today, but we did get 5 verses done. Hey, that's really good for us. You know that. 5 verses on a Sunday morning, we will take that. I'm going to have you stand to next week as we continue this study. We're going to see 2 different responses to the fall of this economic system. You're going to see the response of the citizens of Babylon, that is, those who are a part of this system during the tribulation. You're going to see their response, and you're going to see the response of the citizens in heaven. That's going to be us, those taken in the rapture and up with the Lord while this system is happening down on earth. You're going to see those 2 different responses. They're going to be very different. So here's an assignment. Go home tonight. Worship team, come on up. Go home later tonight, sometime this week. Read the rest of this chapter. I want you to specifically be watching for those 2 different responses, that of the world and that of heaven. I want you to read the next 5 verses, Revelation chapter 19, verses 1 through 5, and see the response of heaven there to the fall of Babylon. And then I want you to take a good, hard look at the system that we live in. And I want you to ask yourself some real tough questions. Here's the main thing. Here's the main thing that we need to know. We are stuck in this system. We are absolutely stuck in this system. I mean, we could do the commune thing. We could all of us get together, buy some property, and go live, you know, in that sense, agrarian, in a commune. You know what? Let's just do that. Who's in? See?
No internet.
No, yes. Amen. Apart from that, we have to do what Jesus prayed for us to do. In John chapter 17, in his prayer, he prayed, Father, I'm not asking that you take them out of the world. No, we need believers in the world because there's unsaved people that we got to reach. We have to stay here. We are stuck in this. There's nothing we can do about it unless we do the commune thing. But here's where we got to be, folks. I'm going to give you the Christian cliche. Here it is. In it and not of it. We got to be in this world, but this world cannot be in us. If the love of this world, this system, if the love of the things of the world, the products, the merchandise, if the love of those things is in us, the love of the Father is not. If we trust in this system, we are about as dumb as a bunch of box of rocks. If we trust in this system, if this is our security, oh man, I would think last handful of years should have shook that out of you. If we're trusting in this system, we're fools. I think of the parable about Jesus and the farmer. He was having a market year. He said, I'm going to have so much produce. I'm going to have to build bigger barns. I'm going to have to, this is great. I'll build bigger barns and then I'll sit back and enjoy comfort and ease. It's going to be great. Jesus said, you fool, today your soul is going to be required of you. Today the Lord's coming for you. You put your security and your love in something that will not stand the test of time.